Welcome to tonight's episode of Well Rounded Corners. I'm Robert.
And I'm Ruthann.
And we're delighted to have with us this evening a very special guest, and we'll get to him in just a moment.
First, I'd like to remind everyone about our website, wellroundedcorners.com. You can also listen to us in the archives of our BBS radio page or live every other Tuesday on BBS Radio Channel 1. All past shows are in our archives and can be downloaded for free on wellroundedcorners.com. And I want to apologize in advance for my voice. I'm just getting over the respiratory stuff that's been going around. So if I lose my voice in the middle of a sentence, pardon me, and I'll catch up later.
Absolutely. Well, we're delighted to welcome back Cliff High from HalfPastHuman.com. He's the head of the WebBot Project, an organization that releases forecasts of the future by examining differences over time and online shifts in language. Now, in the interest of time, we're going to skip the description of the WebBot Project and how it works. Cliff has probably said it 10,000 times and is probably tired of it. So if you're new to the concept...
I don't know that it's quite that many, but you're right on the letter there.
Well, if you're new to the concept, just please go to halfpasthuman.com. You can read about it there. You can listen to any of his previous interviews. Cliff, great to have you on. Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, and nice to be here, and Happy New Year to everybody listening.
Well, we thought, just so that we'd make sure and have time, we're going to start with the questions that we've been getting from the audience first. And the question we get asked most above anything else is about silver and gold. And I'm sure you probably know this and see this coming. We've gotten several questions about, you know, the prices of silver, the rapid increase that you've forecasted. If you could just give us your outlook on that, and I know this isn't investment advice, just your thoughts on that subject.
Yeah, at the moment we're waiting for the fulfillment of the what we call the third temporal marker out of this little group, this cluster that was begun with the beginning of the firefighter word starting to show up first in suits in California, and then later on with the assault on the people in the East. And these three temporal markers are a cluster that appear before silver starts a price rise. Now, here's something you need to be aware of. There is a super huge bubble going on at the moment. The most gigantic bubble that's ever been in existence on this planet, bar none, exists at this moment. This is in the bonds, in the Anglo-American world, the bond backing for our entire financial economy. Now, there's one other connection here with the FIRE word, which turns out to be the FIRE is an acronym for a finance-based economy, not a manufacturing economy, and that's where we are now. And it was apparently coined back a while back by Bill Gross over at PIMCO Investments. So there's all these connections to this particular meme, and we're waiting for this last temporal marker before we expect a very large rise in silver. Now, the reason the silver is going to go up is because the hyperinflation that is currently hitting the bonds, driving them to 300- and 400-year highs, higher than we saw with the John Law New Orleans and the Louisiana Purchase fiasco in France in the 1700s, which, you know, caused ripples that tore Europe apart for decades thereafter. And we're at this point right now. So these bond bubbles will collapse. That will be part of the background that will be going on that will basically propel the silver rise. There's also one other component, and that is that physical silver is an extremely short supply, apparently even more so than gold, especially since gold's being counterfeited so readily. Pressure on both sides, the pressure on the money being hyperinflated, but now we don't see it. You see some level of inflation, you see the rise in prices in the foods and so on, but it's not hyperinflation. The hyperinflation is being diverted by the way that the banksters are managing the financial economy, the FIRE economy, and they're putting it all into bonds. When that goes, it will have to go somewhere. And at that same time, all the dollar will be being repudiated and repatriated back to the U.S. So these combined factors will hit the United States and England too, and to a certain extent Australia and Canada, harder than most of the rest of the world relative to the currency and the silver price. So it won't be a good thing. I suspect we'll probably be getting into the first rush of the silver rise before the March equinox. And if I had to, I'm not a betting guy because betting is kind of silly, but if I had to take a stab at it, I would say sometime around the third week in in January is when we'll see we should see this temporal marker, this last one, go off relative to the linguistic pressures that we're noticing now.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. And you know, the firefighter thing you mentioned, I just wanted to ask you about that. That I remember you saying that before it happened, and I'm assuming the occurrence of that is that related to the firefighter tragedy that happened recently?
Correct. It's a very wide meme, and I was very sad to see that because a lot of my relatives are actually involved in things like smoke jumping and so on, and I've had an association with firefighters all my life, and this is not something you should do to these people. No. You know, it's one thing to take it out on authority and be really irritated, but firefighters are the least evil of all of the governmental services.
Yes.
And should be respected, you know. They place their lives at risk in a horrible way, in a way that police don't. It's one thing to contemplate being shot. It's another thing to contemplate going on in and risk having your lungs burned out trying to save someone.
Absolutely.
Yes, or a house falling on you. Yes.
Correct.
Burning houses.
That was a horrible, horrible tragedy. And you forecast, I remember hearing you on Rinsed talking about that just. Seems like it was just days before it happened.
It should have been about 6 days because we were feeding off of the immediacy data as part of this new project that I'm working on, the immediacy data intelligence report. The issue for us is that the language that we've been monitoring has changed over time in a fundamental nature. I have some speculation as to why that's the case, but it's kind of just an interesting linguistic diversion at the moment. Nonetheless, it has changed. And what we find is that our early days, we had lots of long-term data sets so we could look way out into the future. Now the long-term data is still there, but we're swamped by immediacy data, which really has a short-term value. But the immediacy data, even though it burns itself out, so to speak, the forecasts we can get from that are very short-term, at most 4 weeks out. Even though that's the case, we get a lot of really interesting details and some, as we see, some very prescient wording.
Hmm. Well, that's... Yeah, it does. Is this related to the time changes that you've been speaking of? You know, the acceleration, or I don't know if acceleration is maybe not the right word, but I think you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah, perceptually, certainly we're all feeling it accelerated, whether we're slowing down or more events, it's hard to say. But it is related to that. The way the language is changing, though. I have some suspicion, if I was going to get into it linguistically, that I may be able to correct for some of this, and it has to do with the nature of the languages that are now hitting the internet and the stuff that's being digitized from those languages. So, for instance, English is a very good language for dealing with digital components. It's not very good with dealing with time because some languages like Latin have... five different types of modes. English only has four. Other languages might have six, seven, and eight. Those that have more modes seem to have modes that are less solid, and they seem to be directing more of their emotion into what I'm calling the immediacy data. So it's because we're getting the flush of, if you will, the flush of information being digitized in Indonesia, all throughout Polynesia, where they're able to get to computers, Melanesia and all these other Southeast Asian countries where they have probabilistic modes in their language, they have rhetorical modes in their language, and various different modes that we don't. That, I think, has altered the fundamental nature of the language that's out on the internet. And I may, if we had enough time and I had enough inclination, be able to correct for that with a huge amount of programming and a redo of the lexicon. Make sense?
Oh, yes. Well, what about that just brings something to mind. I'll just ask real quick. A lot of the discussion now has been reduced to these, you know, graphical memes, these pictures with, you know, expressing some kind of ironic or, you know, otherwise kind of thought. And, you know, people are using pictures to communicate more now. How does that play into this? I mean, I know you can't pick that up necessarily. So, I mean, you're aware of what I'm
saying. Oh, certainly.
This phenomenon.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also the that's an extension of the same meme or thought process that leads to texting and that leads to the tweets and the Twitters and then also to all of the audio, none of which we can pick up. We can process some of it if we wanted. I've decided that it's less valuable to swim in the immediacy language of any of the shortened forms of the abbreviated language. But it's not particularly worrisome to me because of the situation that we've got with plenty of language to digest. But it is certainly part of that overall trend. And I think that if we were looking at the human species from a big from a broad perspective, in a broad psychological, or even in more of a philosophical way, like Michael Tesarian might see things, we would look at the species as undergoing a process where our shift has actually been more towards the now and less towards the future and the past, because the language itself is much more expressive of that. We deal now much more with linguistic terms in the form of slang than we do with formal language, and the whole trend for the past few centuries has really accelerated once we got to the internet. If you'll note, that trend existed with High German, Low German, with formal French, with the gutter French. You know, there's always been the Vulgate versus the King's English kind of approach, and there's always been a tendency towards the degradation of language to a more common, if you will, consensus view of reality. And that mere commonality seems to actually have moved from a view of a far future into much more of the now. And if you looked at language, for instance, if you wanted to go back into some of the books in the 1800s and go to Lulu and just sample what they've got, you needn't download the books themselves. Just look at some of the books that were written in the early 1800s and late 1700s, and you'll find that most of their language seems to focus on a far distant future. This comes from their religious prejudice with a viewpoint of, you know, no point worrying about the now because your reward is in heaven. That sort of view. And right at the moment, you'll notice we don't live in that kind of a society. Everything is immediate gratification. So if this is just part of that trend, accept it into language and take it into one step further.
And it also seems to me, that makes me think, things are so speeded up, or our perception seems to be so speeded up. Even the far off seems closer than it used to, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. And that is actually because we're all sitting on a bigger hill of knowledge at the moment. So, for instance, we can actually communicate much. This was sort of spoken of in Star Trek twice. They did two episodes, one in the old Star Trek with William Shatner and then one with Picard, in which they dealt with the same metaphors and meme involved here. And here's their way of approaching it. In the one in Picard, he's transported by the space aliens down to a planet along with the commander of the space aliens. And they're basically at loggerheads at war. They can't communicate with each other. And it's a contention place between the two species, the Federation and the space aliens. I forget what they were called. Anyway, they go down to a planet, and then Picard and the space alien commander have to survive in a camping kind of an environment against a common threat. And then they develop, if you will, through that experience, a common understanding of each other's language, and Picard comes to understand that, oh, these people speak in metaphor. They don't speak in declarative sentences the way that English is designed to. Aha, major breakthrough here. I need not speak in declarative sentences of saying, I went with so-and-so, and we did this, that, and the other thing, because it is known what we did there. Therefore, all I need do is to say Picard and so-and-so at, you know, wherever it was,
Darmok and, yeah, I remember
exactly,
the Darmok.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, and so we are at that point now. So if you want to really encapsulate this kind of thing, all you really have to do to stick a needle into somebody who is aware of the same level of knowledge that you are but does not share your view is to say, David Icke at Wembley.
Wow. What a nice, interesting way to think of it. Yeah, that's a... And the
you
answer
know, that tells me we have won more than anything. You want to stick a needle into anybody that's aware of what's going on the other side of things. Just say that phrase to them that way, and it's provocative, it's contentious without being confrontational, and yet it slaps them in the face with what we both know is true, that the snowball is on our side, rolling down on them.
How true that
that's
is.
Interesting.
We get a lot of questions about. Let me address this first. The Courtney Brown stuff. We've had Courtney on for several times, and great interviews. And you know, we talked about that he, a lot of his work agrees with you, and your work, you know, there's a lot of commonality there. And some people asked us that. What are your thoughts concerning both of your projections or forecasts concerning the events in 2013?
Scares the carp right onto my pond.
Well, I mean,
I got a really good visual on that one, or maybe not a good one.
Well, do you have any more? Is the picture sort of refining a little more in that?
That's actually why we're running the immediacy data intelligence report, because we may indeed be able to run it, be able to fine tune it enough. No promises, but this is our goal. And this is really the point of it, to get a 30-day window, a 30-day warning. Because if we've got that, then I can really do a hard press on people and say, you know, we really think it's within this period of time. If you're in this area, you know, batten down the hatches, you're going to have earthquakes, you got to do this, that, and the other thing, and get really ready for it. Now, for instance, we know from some recent work that's come on out that maybe I'll have a chance to get into it in a report I'll be doing on Thursday, but I'll briefly mention it here, that there's been some Russian work with remote viewing that substantiates the view that this event that we're going to go through in this year, that's going to separate our consciousness this year into a before and an after view of 2013. So at sometime at the end of 2013, you'll be able to say to everybody before, and then you'll be able to say after, and they'll know exactly what you're talking about. You'll needn't say anything, and it'll encapsulate huge amounts of communication between you, because there will be some event that in your region that will be this marker. Now, the Russians have found in their remote viewing study that their area from the Crimea over through into Mongolia is going to get hit with rains that will be massively torrential, that will wash away entire mountains and flatten regions that are hilly now into basically a soggy kind of an inland sea. But they also know that by June, the water has started to recede. So it had built up. Taken some time to build up, apparently, to get to those levels, and had started to recede. So that's given us a better window. So we're of the opinion now, I've been gnawing on this with a few individuals involved, we're of the opinion now that we're looking at something, if we were to put a narrow window on it, that is around the equinox, but before the early part of May. So between March 22nd to, say, May 11th, sometime in there, is a better window than we've had from anything so far.
That's a pretty good, wow, you know, given the scope of events, I mean, that's a pretty good window. But if you can narrow it down to 30 days, that's incredible.
Well, what we're hoping to do is to get a 30-day heads up as
warning.
When
okay.
to start. Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Just because
right.
that's about as far as our immediacy data can really be stretched out. I am much more comfortable with immediacy data at 3 days. I can get it out to 6 days and be really comfortable with that. I did it with the Olympics back in Greece, and I knew 6 days out that the certain athletes were going to have a an accident and so on. If I'd been a betting man, I probably could have used that to my advantage, although I don't, you know, I'm so stupid I wouldn't know how. But in any event... But once I start out to the 30 days, I start losing confidence in it, because we used to fade over into the shorter term data at that point. But it is so difficult now to weed the shorter and longer term data out of the flood of immediacy data, that this is why we're taking this approach.
Well, you mentioned the weather in Russia. Now, I read recently on the Weather Center blog, they're talking about a pretty massive polar vortex collapse, which could lead to some dramatically colder temperatures in the U.S. And I remember, I think you were talking about last year having colder winters and more extreme weather, but particularly more extreme colder weather. Do you think this is a manifestation of that forecast? This ties into it?
Oh, certainly. And in fact, this is the first half of the oscillation. Usually these things progress. What we were looking for there was a particular set of temporal markers which have occurred, and then it was a question, we could go back into those discussions we had. I was always thinking and voicing the hope that, oh, geez, I hope we didn't get the first oscillation, because the first oscillation would be the really harsh temperatures, and we would have had them this year, this winter, extending into maybe and even as far as June. So basically, we would have to face this upcoming global coastal event in a winter condition. We are fortunate here in the Pacific Northwest. Our Russian cousins are not fortunate because the oscillation broke their way. Now, we can expect from work done by Asimov and people in the 50s that the next winter break will break towards this side of the arc of the pole, and we'll get it. So we'll have super cold weather across North America. We'll get a little touch of it this year, but next year will be horrific. Maybe 50, minus 50 in down into Kansas for all we can tell.
Wow.
There is
no way we are prepared for that.
Well, you know, the wonderful thing is, you saying this, people have a chance to consider it and be more prepared than they've been.
Look what's happening to Russia, and anybody that happens to hear what I'm saying now will know later on this year that I'm correct, because part of the oscillation is the super drying that we've got going on here in both halves of the oscillation. It's kind of this figure eight shaped thing, the polar vortex, and it's distended now into Russia. So we're getting the super drought over here. Later on, we'll get the super cold, but it won't necessarily bring wet. And in between there, we'll have fires. So if I'm correct about the collapse of the oscillation next year, between now and that horrific winter, we will unfortunately have to go through a period of time that may lead to a layer of smoke and ash over pretty much the northern hemisphere.
Mm.
Well, that dovetails really nicely into the geology questions that people have been asking. Talking about one person mentioned that there's been an increased number of earthquakes, in the Pacific Northwest, and
rim.
What are your thoughts, and what do the reports or the data show about that?
Well, it's part of the process. Bear in mind that 12/21/2012 was not the end. That was a misinterpretation. Really, it's the beginning of a period of transition. And yes, if some people are correct, it's the beginning of a 2,000-year period of transition. Now, it kind of makes sense if we wanted to look at things a certain way. The descriptions of the photon belt and energy-wise and so on, if we were to think of those and superimpose them over this particular view of our ages as the Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age, then as we were rotating around in such a way, when we finally get around to the photon belt, where we're in a much more energetic period of time, we could say that that is analogous to, and may even be, a cause of an actual Golden Age, in the sense that we're getting more light and more thoughts and more energy, etc. If so, however, it's not like we are walking along on the street and we step off the curb and we're in the Golden Age. That step takes 72 years, and we're just beginning that process now. As part of that process, we're going to get more energy coming in through the solar system. This has been demonstrated by NASA, ESA, Russians, everybody, and we're seeing those effects on all of the planets. One of those effects is the planet is actually growing, and so the trembles that were the increase in signs of instability all around us, not just earthquake, but also sinkholes, the groaning, the projection of the, bear in mind, the groaning is actually energy from space coming in that is going to make our planet grow. And it's been hitting the skin of the planet, the mantle, in such a way as to cause the mantle to vibrate out sound. So we know the energy is just flooding into the plasma core of the planet, and it's about to have an expansion episode. This constant wobbliness is exactly what we're about to experience, and it should get up to a threshold, and that'll be our global coastal event. And then we'll calm down over a period of years, the way that you have a big earthquake and then you have lots of aftershocks in a normal period of time, and it would calm down. Now, our calming down will be brief relatively, and we'll go through probably a couple of more of these episodes over the next couple of weeks.
That leads into the sun, and we had some people ask about the original thing that started your work, the sun disease. I know you're talking about the energy from space here, but any data recently about the sun, any changes that we should
actually
be aware of with
that? All kinds of stuff. If you watch space weather or follow the Russian less censored version. You have to really understand Cyrillic, though. If you look at what's going on, you see the sun is exhibiting a very different kind of behavior. Not only does it at the moment have multiple poles, but it's also going through a period of time where For those things that should pop off CMEs, they're not. And that is worrisome to a number of people because we're getting these magnetic structures that, for all intents and purposes, should lead to the next stage of filament forming and pop off something, and they're not. And there's some kind of different process going on. Now, is the sun itself about to expand? We don't know. Bearing in mind it's a solid body, it's not a big gaseous thing, you know, in a new state of nuclear agitation that they would have you believe. It's an it's a hard-skinned surface sphere in there that is experiencing electrical energy at a huge level. And so that electrical energy, all kinds of things have been occurring at the far reaches of that. The X-ray levels are way up, various different kinds of high-energy hydrogen molecules coming in are way up. So, and it's ramping up at a very fast rate, not quite parabolic, but certainly steeper than the steps we would normally see going, you know, for humans. And so that increase in grade has me... It gives me a little bit more confidence in our global coastal event occurring before mid-year.
Yeah. Well, that you know, I was thinking about the changes that in you know, they used to publish data about where the North Pole was, and this is on our planet, you know, where the magnetic North Pole was, the Chandler wobble, things like that. And then it seems around, I don't know, about within 5 years or so, that data just stopped. You know, they'll just... This is as far as it's come. I think it was 2003 for the pole, and then nothing more. And the last few points, it was just racing towards Russia. And so I'd like to ask you about the magnetic pole situation. Any info you can provide there? I know that, you know, there's a little pole kind of forming down in the southern Indian Ocean or Pacific Ocean. I'm not sure which, but
yeah, on the Indian side. Yeah. The issue with the magnetic poles is less worrisome to me at the moment because I don't. A magnetic pole shift is a problem only if the magnetosphere is in a weakened state, which it is. A magnetic pole shift around the planet Earth 4,000 years ago wouldn't have impacted anybody. It might have alerted the birds, but I don't think anything else would have really felt it. But our issue now is that our magnetosphere is basically a colander. It's a sieve. And this is coincident with and has occurred over these last 5 or 10 years, and it's coincident with the loss of information we've got from the various governmental sources in the Anglo-American world, and thus my heavy reliance on what you can get out of the Russians and the Europeans. But at the moment, as the vortex, which is essentially a magnetic structure in the pole, begins to collapse and has caused the horrific levels of cold in Russia, that's part of the whole sign of what occurred at the last time that the Mayan long count ended, 5,115 years ago. They're coincidental to that, and they were really smart when they started their long count. Coincidental to that, way back when, there was flash freezing that occurred all around the planet. Glaciers formed in 2 weeks, they estimate. I mean, really short periods of time in very high areas of the Andes that had not existed prior to that because it was too warm. Same thing with Switzerland. That was when that... poor fellow had gotten wounded and got frozen. It was in a flash freeze episode. And so we've got that ahead of us. But that is a result not of the magnetic pole itself moving around, but its impact moving around inside the colander now. Because these holes, if you look at the holes of the magnetosphere, it's very much evenly spaced. And as the energies come on in, they're going to be drawn over towards the collapsing vortexes, and that's where we end up with these horrifically cold temperatures. And we've seen the results of that before, you know, the poor old mammoth frozen with the daisies in his mouth, that kind of thing.
Now we're seeing that with Russia. I mean, right now, you know, the pictures coming out of Russia with this horrible cold that they've been experiencing, it's almost another planet, you know, it seems.
I got a friend of mine in Belarus, and he refines silver for a living and other metals. That's what he does. He's a metallurgist. And they use lots of electricity and, unfortunately, lots of acids. And so he's got these buildings that are all ceramic that have big, giant vats of acids that they basically dunk things into, you zap it with electricity, and suck the metal out of. And he sent me pictures of the atmosphere in there as the acids are reacting to the extreme cold and the electrical influences as they still try and work. Some of their material processes have failed in the extreme cold. It's very interesting.
Wow.
And also he's got hoarfrost that's outside inside of the walls, mm-hmm. sticking out 4 and 5 inches everywhere. He's like working in this big ice cave. None of the buildings are heated because they've never been needed before, because there was just that ambient temperature of all the electricity. Not anymore though.
Wow,
that's astonishing. We're about to take our one and only break here, but I'm going to ask you right before we go into the break. I got an unusual question, and I don't know what this is referring to, but I hope you do. Somebody asked about the strobe flickering light sensitivity with fluorescent lighting. They said that you were going to that you had checked on that, or that you were curious about it. Just wondered if you had any information about that.
Yeah, I've actually become a real firm incandescent bulb addict, having gone through the process of looking at that. I have a sensitivity in my eyes to strobing because of my Vortex reader and what it does on computers in terms of how it presents the words. And so I'm not able to handle 1080i TV. I'm able to see the strobe in transition because my eyes have been trained. And so I went and I started looking at some of this, and as we've gotten from regular fluorescence at 60 cycle, we've in essence boosted it with the mini fluorescence, and we're now dealing with flicker rates that are in the 2500 and 34 and above frequency levels. Those are the reaching of the far range of what I was dealing with my Vortex reader. In fact, I had set my Vortex reader at a 2,000, capped it at 2,000 words per minute, because I didn't want to throw anybody who was not normally susceptible into any kind of a grand mal seizure by reaching that particular level. These bulbs, though, at 2,534 are over that, and so they're screaming out energy at you, and it's not advisable. Even the mini fluorescents are not a good idea.
No wonder I really don't like those. They just bother me, and I couldn't put my finger on why.
Incandescents are down in the less than 400 range, less than 400 vibrations that you're perceptible.
Yeah, they're definitely better, you know, energy wise, but utility bill wise, but yeah,
just bothers us. I just can't tolerate them. And I never really thought about why. I just knew I didn't like them. But we've got to take a break. And so we will be right back with Cliff High in just a moment. And we'll see you in a moment.
Want to start a website but don't know how? No problem. The experts at OCS Solutions have you covered. We offer a complete range of internet services, from domain name registration, web hosting, and even our easy-to-use website building tool that allows you to create a website with just a few clicks and be live in minutes. Pick from thousands of templates and samples, upload your own content, or use a mix of both. It's entirely up to you. And don't worry, you won't outgrow OCS. We host websites both small and large. Domain names start at just $8 a year and come loaded with plenty of extras to get you started. Visit OCSDomains.com to learn more, or call 1-800-672-8415. That's OCSDomains.com, or call 1-800-672-8415.
Reiki is a Japanese relaxation technique that promotes healing and balance. It is a form of energy work that helps unblock areas that are affected by illness, stress, grief, anxiety, or other types of trauma, and it can be given in person or from the Reiki practitioner to the recipient at a distance. It is gentle and soothing and is simple to learn as well. Our bodies have the natural ability to maintain health and heal themselves when energy flows smoothly throughout our energy system. And Reiki works well either by itself or along with traditional or alternative medical treatments to help keep energy channels flowing and the mind and body in balance. I offer Reiki, the Hochi, and other types of energy sessions in my home in Florence, Alabama, as well as distance Reiki to any location in the world. I also teach Reiki classes from levels 1 through Karuna Reiki Master, as well as La Hochi. To learn more, please visit alabamareiki.com. That's alabamareiki.com.
And welcome back to Well-Rounded Corners. We have Cliff High with us tonight, noodling on things. You know, we were talking right before the break about lights and whatnot, but we kind of moved into electromagnetic sensitivity. You know, I know several people, and I suffer myself from vertigo, inner ear disturbances. And just on a whim, I thought about, you know, is this maybe a manifestation of electromagnetic sensitivity? And I have a brass singing bowl, you know, from Tibet. And I just had the little, you know, the urge to try that to see, you know, I actually covered my fiance's ear. I know that sounds strange, but with it, it acted as sort of a Faraday cage, a very cheap, you know, I know brass is a poor conductor. And it reduced her, you know, ear buzzing, you know, ear issue just while she had that on. You know, any does this electromagnetic sensitivity that we've been talking about, you think it's related to vertigo or these other kind of things that we're dealing with? Is this electrically based, you know?
Yeah, actually it can be, and it can be very subtle, persistent, annoying, easy to cure, though, if it indeed is the case, because here's what's going on. It's a combination of factors. We have a society where you're not really entrained to the idea of walking around and grounding yourself freely. So usually you don't walk barefoot in the grass or in any area where you will ground out energy-wise. And so that's an issue. And you need to be grounded frequently during the day just to shed the electrostatic charges that you're going to build up. Plus, our society is now filled with all this electro smog in the form of Wi-Fi and then the, you know, the chemtrails, all the cell towers, all of the Tetra radiation and the Gwen towers.
Smart meters.
And everything else. Correct. All of the stuff beaming out. And it's beaming out in microwaves, but the microwaves cause changes in the level of the air moisture, and it causes dehydration around them. So if you stand around one of the things in the TSA, one of the things you'll notice about these TSA employees that are near the machines is they have dry skin continuously. They exhibit all kinds of signs of drying hair because they're subjected to the ionizing radiation. By the way, they should be drinking at least 2 cups a day of lemon balm tea. That's what's required at Hanford over here at the nuke plant workers to deal with that same issue. And you could also drink the lemon balm tea as an effort to hydrate yourself and reduce some of the effects of the ionizing radiation. But for tinnitus and stuff, what you're going to have to do is go a step further. You're suffering at that point the buildup of the salts in your body because you're being dehydrated by the environment around you. You're being dehydrated by the tendency of our food sources to extract water from us. So, for instance, if you drink anything with caffeine, it's a diuretic, or parsley. And so you're going to be peeing out more water than you're taking in. So you need to be hydrated. You have to understand that our food sources, anything prepared commercially, anything that has an ingredient list in it, will have salt added to it, or MSG, or some other form of a dehydrating substance. Again, this affects your body in terms of those vibrations that it becomes sensitive to, because it dries out the little tiny hairs that are all throughout our body, not just in your ear, but in your lungs, the cilia, and in your mm-hmm. intestines, the villi. So all of these little tiny hairs that cause movement within the body dry out, and as they do so, they become more dense and more crystalline, and it literally changes their frequency. And so you start picking up frequencies that you never heard before. Sort of make sense?
Wow. Yes, actually, it does make sense. Oh,
okay. So to get around that.
Yeah, I never really thought of that.
Yeah, if you're sensitive at that level, as opposed to having the other form of sensitivity, which has to do with the blood and the gases, okay, that's a different kind of electrosensitivity. But if you have this water-based sensitivity, which I find to be the most common, it's a case of being dehydrated and not being grounded. So you can probably find relief if you can ground your bed at night. You know, get a little piece of copper wire or something, go it out through a window or a hole in the wall and put it into the ground. Or walk around barefoot for a while every day on grass and that kind of stuff, not asphalt. You want to be uninsulated from the ground so that you literally ground out some of these energies. And then at the same time, you want to raise your water levels and decrease your salt intakes.
That is very, very interesting, and thank you so much for that information.
Yeah, that personally affects, I know Ruth Ann and me as well. I mean, I'm sensitive to, you know, these frequencies. I have Wi-Fi in my home. I know I shouldn't. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, everyone, I can't say everyone, but so many people do. I mean,
and I guess it doesn't matter. Your neighbor has it too, right? I mean, you
correct.
Know,
I don't have Wi-Fi here, but if I turn it on my PC, I can pick it up from either from neighbors on either side of me. So I'm being bombarded with it, whether I like it or not.
Right. Yeah.
So staying hydrated, lemon balm tea. You said
lemon balm is good for the ionizing effects of radiation. It won't really help with the tendonitis approach. It'll make you a lot calmer. That's one of its side effects, is that it calms you and boosts your ki value in a lower sense in your hara. But no, it's not directly related to the tendonitis and the frequency issue. That's entirely this salt and water versus the grounding issue. And you can actually see it in some people, because there will be a tendency for a dryness around the little muscles of the eye, so their eyes will feel stiff. They'll complain about the dry eyes. And this is something you'll know you're sensitive this way if you've grown into this, as opposed to it being a lifelong condition. Because there's the other kind of electromagnetic sensitivity that you discover when you're a kid, and that has to do with the nature of your blood.
Well, I have to chuckle because I was putting eye drops in during the break thinking how dry my eyes were.
Well, there you go. There you go.
Well, let's talk about, if you don't mind talking about that a minute, about with the sensitivity with the blood-based electromagnetic sensitivity. I haven't heard of this particular type.
You find it in individuals that it's a sort of a side effect of what they call hemochromatosis, which is a fatal blood disease, but it turns out it's actually more of a condition than a disease, often called the Irish disease. And it's related to too much minerals in your water source that build up in your body with no readily available way of getting out, and it leads to a ultimately to death through kidney disease and this kind of thing. It actually means that, for instance, though, that Irish women don't suffer anemia as much as women elsewhere because they don't have the iron loss in the blood loss, because their iron sources are coming in through the water. But it does mean that the men in Ireland build up towards rage tendencies that's often fueled and, again, triggered by dehydration caused by alcohol. The rage tendency has to do with too much iron built up in the blood, and it affects the heme, the little part of the hemoglobin, and its rate of spin within the you have to understand that your blood doesn't just, like, flow and dribble through your veins or your arteries. It actually spins. All your little, everything is spin in universe. And so your blood vessels spin, and that's how they actually do their action of gathering up carbon dioxide and other pollutants and imparting oxygen as they go along, is this spinning process accomplishes this. Now, the spin rate at which they spin is an electrically sensitive component. It is, so you're electrically sensitive in your blood at a plasma level as opposed to a crystalline level with the little cilii. Makes sense? So it's the spin rate that changes, and then you become sensitive to electromagnetic influences. Now, in California, I know in some of the valleys, the water is heavily polluted with selenium. So they have a different spin rate and a different level of electromagnetic sensitivity, but underlying it, it's the same overly saturated metals in the blood condition.
What can someone do about that? I mean, you know, not in a medical sense necessarily, but I mean, you know, we're obviously, again, I'm going to disclaim, we're not providing medical advice here, but what are your thoughts on how someone...
Well, just at a chemical level, you stop the ingestion. If you're in Ireland and you know you've got really heavily polluted water with lots of iron and you're male, well, maybe you'd better look at some kind of an iron filtration system just to get rid of it. It is, as I say, less of a problem with women and can in some cases be beneficial to them. They don't really suffer from hemochromatosis until they're into postmenopausal. So, you know, at that point, they need to pay attention to it. But it's not really good to have this condition for your life anyway, because it leads to all different kinds of other issues, literally the hardening of the arteries and that are not plaque buildup and so on. But you change your diet, and then you can get into all of the various ways of getting these kinds of metals out of your body. Now, one of the ones I'm exploring at the moment is zeolite. The reason I'm doing it is because when Fukushima went off, it left a pattern of radiation around pretty much the whole hemisphere of the planet now. Northern hemisphere has been pretty much given a even coating of radiation all over the place. And I was looking at some of the arthritic symptoms that I've been suffering and wondering whether some of them are related to an increase at this level. Zeolite is an interesting kind of a clay, because it has a Buckminster Fullerene hollow center that seems to be magnetically sensitive to pulling out minerals of all kinds, whether or not they're ferrous and are magnetically sensitive themselves. So it's been said to be able to be used to reduce the influence on your body of, you know, the mercury from your fillings and this kind of thing, and that will make you less magnetically or less electromagnetically sensitive with a continual use, and it's not particularly harmful. Now, here's something that I like. I like the approach of do no harm. So, you know, grounding yourself on the grass is not going to do you any harm unless you're a fool and you step on a snake or something, right? And then that's your problem. I just advise walking on the grass, not on the snakes. So in this case, you know, the clay, unless you ate vast quantities of it, is not going to do you much harm, and it can indeed maybe strip out some of these materials from your body if that was your problem. It may not be, so you got to be real careful about self-diagnosis on this.
Sure.
However, absolutely. It's easy with the water one. You know, it's easy to cure. You drink a couple of glasses of water, the tendonitis goes away a little bit. You think, oh, maybe if I drink some more water every day, it'll go away more. And geez, okay, it doesn't hurt so much. And you pee a little bit. That's the downside.
Right. Oh, that'd be all right.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Everything we're discussing is. I mean, you know, like you said, you walk on the grass, it's okay. You can't overdo that. Walking's good. So. No, the excellent information, and electromagnetic sensitivity is something. I mean, whether you're extremely sensitive or not, even if you're only mildly sensitive, with the saturation we have of it, you know,
it's terrible.
Hard to avoid it. I mean,
yeah.
And unless you put yourself in, you know, a dual-lined Faraday cage or something, and just spend your life in there, I don't know how you're going to avoid it. You may not even escape it then.
No, it's actually very difficult. We're in a fairly isolated way here because we have a metal roof that I went to the trouble of grounding on all the corners. Now, according to the code, that's illegal. You can't have more than one ground per property, but no one's ever enforced that to my knowledge. But it does help because the grounds are copper rod 6 feet into the earth in an environment that is perpetually wet. So we lose a lot of the electromagnetic sensitivity just because of our environment. And we're running at the moment 11 inches more, I think 11 or 12 inches more inches of rain this year than we do normally. So it's been an exceptional year that way.
That's I just wanted to go through and make sure that we had we've really addressed a lot of the wide range of questions. I mean, a lot of the questions that we have been receiving, they fall into several categories. We've really discussed a lot of them. We haven't really talked much about the one person is mentioning the Cousin Alexi language, and I vaguely remember something about that a couple years ago.
Yeah, Cousin Alexi is in a that was in a set that we still have unfulfilled, but it may be that it's an issue of the level of visibility was an unknown on that. We thought that there was going to be a level of visibility that would have implied that it would have hit TV stations and so on. That could have been a misinterpretation, and the level of visibility might have been only for the Internet. And there have been a number of candidates for Cousin Alexi kind of material on the Internet, not quite in the same background situation that we had described. But here's our curiosity. When we first described this, this was Cousin Alexi is a space alien, a cousin, if you will, a humanoid that looks like a human in some way, though does not. So you might stop and think, oh, he's a little odd looking or something. It would catch your eye, but he wouldn't be, you know, he doesn't have tendrils coming out of his nostrils or anything. So not so much that, you know, we would all stare at him. But still, it would be an oddity, and he was supposed to be videoed during a chaotic period of time almost accidentally, while people were interviewing somebody else, this guy would be videotaped, and then there would be a level of visibility that we would all see this or have it available to us. Now, here's the thing. During the period of time that a Cousin Alexi forecast was out there, three videos showed up. None of them had the background information of the chaos that we had associated with the Cousin Alexi. But at that time, there was indeed Cousin Alexi kind of chaos going on. It was just that it was not within the three videos. And so that may have been a misinterpretation. And so if that's the case, then one of these three videos may indeed show a very real space alien, and it's pointed out on YouTube. One of the videos was a shot from Brazil in which these people were out in the jungle and were startled by this space alien that basically came bumbling on through their camp and freaked them out. And there's like maybe a minute and 2 seconds or something in the video. There's another one of the videos. All these are on YouTube. Another one of the videos was a guy who was showing a looks like grapes or something. I didn't speak the language I think it may be a derivative of Polish or related to that. I wasn't really paying that much attention to it, but and there's no subtitles or anything. But he's showing this run of grapes and what apparently looks like a long line of grapes that maybe 100 feet or more, 100 meters or more even, and half of it is just sort of fallen over. And in the background, up against a large brick wall, you see this flash of this space alien, a fellow that looks like one of the tall grays, but a little bit more humanoid, with sort of a sheet or some kind of clothing kind of loosely held around his body, come out of an entrance on one side of the wall, see the camera, and then hurriedly go down, and I mean really fast, go down the length of this wall and disappear into the woods. So much so that at the very end of the video, the old guy who was doing the video moves his camera over there because his eyes had been disturbed by the vision of this fellow running down the wall and jumping into the woods, but he wasn't quite fast enough to catch it. And then the third video was definitely out of Russia. It was showing a train station and multiple kinds of trains, and it appeared to be some sort of a security camera on top of a tower. And you could see this individual that looked like a human, but disturbingly not. The head was disturbingly oddly shaped. I'm not going to say cone head, but it looked an awful lot like the rounded skull kind of things that we would see in an otherwise proportional human, not a 9-foot-high guy or anything. But the head was distinctly odd, and the shoulder structure was very odd, as were the hands. And there were shadows that appear to show four fingers or four digits on the hand instead of five. And it was just a flash, maybe 20 seconds, as this individual walks through this train yard and disappears between these two trains. And so it may have been one of those. Now, all three of these videos came out during a period of very intense international, like we've got going on in Syria at the moment, that kind of chaos. So that could have been going on in the background and not ever been captured, and it would have been a flaw in our interpretation. Which of the three is valid, I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah, that I remember you talking about it. I didn't remember the Cousin Alexei label, but...
It was just something I'd put on there because I thought it would be Eastern European, and because this individual, insofar as our data showed, that he'd been held in a jail in Russia or Eastern Europe and escaped as part of the chaos that was going on.
Huh. Well, that's certainly possible. Yeah, that's something I've noticed about your work too, and I think I heard one other person mention it one time on an interview, but I've noticed it. You know, the contents, the little details that you get right are astonishing. Like this firefighter thing, I remember the general, the disgraced general, and I think there was, I guess the recent
Reyes.
Yeah, I mean, just these little details are so astonishingly correct. And but the time can sometimes seem to lag about a year. Like the Summer of Hell kind of. The next summer seemed to be the Summer of Hell, not that summer, and it always seems that, or not always, but there's often when there is a time discrepancy, it seems to be, to me anyway, a year, something?
Yes, that does appear frequently, but there's a, there's sort of a twofold explanation for that. The Summer of Hell was actually a very wide meme, and it was actually going around the whole planet. So our Summer of Hell arrived at the end of it here in the U.S., but the Summer of Hell was adequately described and accurately described because it started in Asia and worked its way around the planet. So it was I should have actually probably have reworded that to have been a seasonal transition, flowing around the planet kind of a thing, as opposed to the Summer of Hell label. But I take your point. That was a very wide meme that took a whole year to reach around to where people in the United States felt it. And so there are these issues of the fact that we're dealing with primarily an English-speaking audience up to a certain point within the Internet. Now it's gone really global, but we've got global inputs. But of course, none of these predictions are going to be ubiquitously felt. We try and get the large ones that will affect the most people, and it will, in some cases, take a long time. So I actually think it'll be almost 2 years before the people in Finland really experience the global coastal event. And that's 2 years after we've had it up here. They'll know it's coming. They may have heavy rains and so on. But the coastal part of it actually may take 2 years to get there. So this may be an event in that sense that runs for 5 or 6 or 7 years. We just don't have any way of telling ahead of time because of the nature of time and how I originally coded the lexicon that gave me the clues. You have to understand that we broke language down when we started into three broad categories, because I noticed this easily accessible division for my software. That was really the only reason I took that approach. And the three broad categories were the longer-term things, and those are the language. Those kinds of language are like legal terms. You know that feeling in the pit of your stomach when you're served a subpoena? That means that you're experiencing a long-term disruption to your life in the language on that document. And so you see those kind of words show up on the internet. They have a long-term kind of an impact. And so the way in which the language broke down, long-term, short-term, and immediacy, was a wild-ass guess on my part. And so in many cases, the individual words that I assigned to individual categories can be off. I may have assigned something to a shorter term, and it's actually a longer term. And thus, that would allow almost a year and 4 months discrepancy.
Yeah, it's funny, the very, well, it seems like a lot of the forecasts do have that lag. I mean, it's certainly fine. I mean, you know, the fact that you get the information at all, especially those little details, is astonishing and far better than a lot of other methods. You know, I think forecasting the firefighter incident, for example, was that's an unfortunate, a tragic hit. And who could have really seen that? You know, that's a very esoteric thing to see ahead. So it's astonishing.
And that's part of our real issue and our problem. There's nothing we can do about this. I've determined that even if we had known and rushed in and told these people that this was likely to happen, that circumstances would nonetheless pursue it such that it would occur. I'm not saying determinism. I'm still thrashing around with the mechanisms involved. But I'm of the opinion now that we get this foreknowledge. And actually, the year's discrepancy actually helps us, because the longer time you have to push against that mountain of event that's rolling down towards you, the more chance you have to make at least some level of difference, at least in its impact on your own life. So there, foreknowledge is useful. But the problem with it is all those marvelous details, all the stuff about personality and all of that sort of stuff. Usually all that percolates up from the immediacy data. That's why the firefighter thing was relatively easy, because that's what we're doing now is sort of surfing the immediacy data wave. We'll be able to get a lot of hits like that. We'll probably find initially that we'll get maybe 2 out of 10 right, but as we go on here, we'll be able to refine our technique and increase it. And I'm hoping, like I say, my whole goal is to be able to just be going along, and maybe sometime in February or March or April, all of a sudden we'll get an immediacy report that says, hey, global coastal event 30 days from now. That's what we're looking for.
Well, we just have a little bit of time left, and I want to ask you before we go, what is the do you see anything in the immediacy data within the next few weeks, the next month, or maybe the next few days that we should be concerned about, or that you find interesting?
We've got all kinds of stuff here. I've been taking notes. I'd have to get over to another chunk of the software here. So if you give me a minute, I can actually get at that. We have a lot of things relative to the kick the can down the road. There's a fiscal cliff business that they're talking about, right?
Fiscal mess.
Exactly. And none of that's going to be a real issue until March. So I wouldn't worry so much about that. We do have the idea, though, at some level, that the 2 weeks from now, it's all going to fall apart, that there will be some sign of a good communication, you know, people coming together at the, you know, Republican-Democrat level, the crime bosses come together and shake hands and agree to fleece the sheeple a particular way. And then the data says that near the end of the month, the early optimism sours, and we get into a situation of rancor and contention again between the two crime bosses. Now, the reason I'm saying crime bosses is because the issue of the warfare kind of thing that you might see with actual crime bosses is starting to arise. So I would say that one of the things that's curious about the immediacy data is a suggestion that we might see actual factional hits start appearing. We won't look at them that way. It'll be an unfortunate heart attack, a small car wreck, a small plane, you know, the toaster that accidentally fell off the shelf into the bathtub, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah,
so, yeah, just, you know, happens all the time. But these will be people at a minion level that they will have to alibi it. And so those people that are going to be paying attention, I think, over these next 3 or 4 weeks will be a little startled as to what's going to be going on.
I'd be that's very insightful. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you this. Fukushima, the spent fuel pool that they so intelligently decided to put on the top floor. does your work, or do you see that collapsing?
Oh yeah. That is really, to the extent that we have to deal with things here, it's the least of our problems. Bear in mind that when the global coastal event hits, 140 nuclear plants in North America are going to be at risk. Some of the data we've got shows nuke plants along coastal areas being swept several hundred miles along with the waves and spewed out all of beaches and stuff. Because of the waves striking at an oblique angle, they're not going to come on shore directly because of the nature of the event that we're looking at. And just the other day, I saw that there's people now saying that a huge section of rock might give way suddenly on the other side of the Great Barrier Reef. That's on the Toba side, the supervolcano side, the side that Courtney Brown's work would suggest was the site at which the people 70,000 years ago nearly took this planet apart and caused their own extinction. And that area is weak. The Great Barrier Reef section, well, that's a Pacific plate. We were always looking for a Pacific plate crack. That would fit with one of our earlier projections, and then that would have an oscillation on the northern side. So we're going to have nuclear plants all across the North America that will find themselves deprived of salt water for cooling, or have too much water, all their pipes being inundated and the whole plants hit by tsunamis if they're too low-lying. Those that are inland are going to be inundated by rain that you cannot understand. The data that we're getting now says that these rivers of rain, I live through the Pineapple Express every damn year. We get this stuff here where a river from the Philippines hits the atmosphere, trucks across the Pacific, sucks up everything it can, and dumps it on our heads for months at a time.
Yes.
But this is nothing compared to what's going to come down. The data from the Russians that is the most recent is on where they were describing it, and they're doing it allegorically, and you have to understand how the Russian language works and the nature of the people and so on, because their view of remote viewing is their approach to it is different. But their language, their textual descriptions are much more verbose and, to me, much more meaningful as a linguist. And so some of their descriptions, they're talking about annual rainfall per hour.
Ooh.
Wow.
So you know, you're talking a fairly serious amount of rain at that level. So this will hit nuke plants in the Midwest. On the East Coast, we're going to get apparently another big wave from the Atlantic side, take out nuke plants there. So Fukushima, even though those fuel rods are going to go, we're going to have that same thing happen here. Because bear in mind, by the way, we have a bunch of those GE plants here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very tragic.
Designed exactly that same way.
Yeah. Well, when yes. The spent fuel pool at Fukushima is the least of your worries, then... Well, that's a concern. So
we're way up on radiation, yeah. And I've just stopped monitoring anymore because it is so consistent that it no longer makes a difference. And then within 6 months from now, we're going to know for sure whether the global coastal event and the remote viewing thing was accurate and to what degree it was accurate. And if it's accurate at any degree, we will have many more Fukushimas to deal with.
Wow.
Well, if we don't have you on before then, we hope that we see you on the other side, and everybody else, all humanity. And
you did a show this way before.
That's true. Yeah.
But now look, though, it's not the end of humanity. No. It is really tough times, challenges. There's a lot in our data that suggests that actually, as bizarre as it sounds, Cousin Alexei and some of his ilk won't really hold our stupidity against us, and they'll come on down and help us out. Plus, some of our guys are going to get really smart and figure out how to deal with radiation as a subset of dealing with the free energy.
Well, like Courtney Brown said, if humans can do it here, we can do it anywhere. It's very, very amazing.
The universe favors us. There's no question, you know.
Yeah, for some reason.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't know why, but we're just going to ride with it.
Well, Cliff, it's been a great show. Thank you very much for being here. I hope our best wishes to Kathy, Igor, and your team there.
Yes.
I hope everything gets better there. So we want to remind everybody, our website, wellroundedcorners.com, all the archives are free. This episode will be up within 24 hours. You can share the archives. They're completely free. Just we ask that you do so in the entirety. Other than that, Cliff, again, thanks for being on. Appreciate
it.
Thank you very much. No problem, guys.
You take care.
Have a great 2013, everybody, and have a good night.